Thanks for listening to Press Play. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film award season, I have a podcast just for you. It's called The Treatment, and it's hosted by Elvis Mitchell. And Elvis really goes beyond the simple plot outline to understand what inspires the people who make these movies, the actors, the filmmakers, the producers. So check it out, The Treatment, on KCRW's iTunes page.
Having a photographer in front of your camera is very different from filming anybody else. He will not just be there and act like himself, so to speak. No, by profession, he reacts in response, using his weapon of choice, his photo camera. The man shoots back. In this case, he wasn't just shooting at me. He had two of us in front of his lens. The other guy, my fellow director, was his oldest son, Giuliano.
That's Wim Wenders in the documentary Salt of the Earth about photographer Sebastião Salgado. We'll talk to the directors of all five Oscar-nominated docs this week, starting today with that other guy, Giuliano Salgado. His father spent his career documenting human suffering, often amongst indigenous people. The conditions at Mexican farms would fit right in. Children working in hot fields, families sleeping in rat-infested hovels, often on concrete floors, unreliable water, and the pay, $8 to $12 a day, that is, if they get paid. Those conditions were documented in a Los Angeles Times investigation, which noted that half the tomatoes, cucumbers, and bell peppers we consumed here in the U.S., they come from Mexico. Now Walmart and the Mexican government have struck a deal to improve conditions for the farm workers. Richard Morosi is the reporter for the LA Times who did that investigation, and he's written about the new agreement. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, you spent 18 months investigating these conditions, and I'm wondering if you could just summarize what you found.
Well, I went to a lot of the huge mega farms that export produce to the United States, and these are enormous farms, hundreds of acres, and they have big labor camps where they house their workforce. So we managed to interview hundreds of folks and get inside these labor camps and found some pretty appalling conditions, including some places where they were withholding wages. When people run up debts, they couldn't leave. These camps have barbed wire fences. There are guards often. Inside the housing, sometimes people, they lack beds. They sleep on the bare floors. There's a lack of reliable water in some of these camps, so they have to bathe in the irrigation canals. And what really, the context of it all is what struck me, is that these folks were working for farms that exported to huge American retailers and restaurant chains who have specific vendor codes of conduct on ways that people in their supply chain should be treated. And they were in, it was very apparent that they were in violation of these standards.
And did they not know that these things were going on at these farms, Walmart and the other restaurants and supermarkets?
Well, you know, some of these, Walmart, for instance, has a social responsibility team that I was told toured some of these camps and went inside some of these camps and presumably saw the same conditions that I saw. But there was little to no evidence that they were doing anything to remedy these situations.
So now Walmart has this agreement with the Mexican government. Tell us about that.
Well, they don't have an agreement directly with the Mexican government. The Mexican government hosted or put together this big alliance of these of producers, growers, and distributors to address social responsibility issues. Walmart has said that they want to work with some of these growers in improving the situation and improving conditions for the at some of these farms. So, in effect, conceding that there are problems in the supply chain. But, you know, there's plenty of folks that are skeptical at this point. There's not many details on how they're going to improve these measures. There are a few positive signs because some of these farms that I wrote about apparently have launched a lot of improvements. They've supplied beds to hundreds of workers, helped fixed water supplies, kicked out the shady labor contractors. So there's already some evidence that the coverage has made some impact.
But you wrote that some of these farms had certificates and seals of approval from Mexican authorities saying that they were actually very good employers, doing the right things, socially responsible, and yet they were amongst the most egregious.
Yeah, Exactly. It tells you a lot about their verification system and how really honest they were about it, and kind of suggest it was all just window dressing. Some of the farms I wrote about were exporters of the year and got awards from the president of Mexico himself. You know, they're very celebrated firms. They boast lots of certifications and claim to be leading companies in Mexico. But, you know, when you go scratch the surface and take a look around at some of these camps, I saw otherwise. And that's what really what kind of drove me into telling the story, because it all looks good on paper. You know, if you look good, you look hard at these supplier codes of conduct of all the major U.S. retailers that import from there, and you look at all the certifications that are given to these Mexican export farms, you think things are wonderful down there. But we, you know, myself and my and photographer Don Bartoletti, we found a much different picture down there once we started looking at these camps. That said, it's hard to really get a true gauge of what's going on down there, in part because it's so difficult to find the camps in the first place. A lot of these big export agribusinesses have numerous labor camps, and they're not on any maps. You know, you have to go out, drive down long dirt roads and find them.
Mm.
And once we did that and got access to the camps, we found the picture was much different than the way they were presenting.
So it's not just Walmart, it's also Safeway. Whole Foods also imports these tomatoes and other vegetables, but Walmart is the biggest importer. And so why is it in their best interest for them to try to get these conditions improved, aside from just on a moral ground?
Well, I think Walmart recognizes that consumers are getting a lot more demanding, or are preferring now that the food they eat, you know, come from be responsibly sourced. Whole Foods has a brand new program called the Responsibly Grown program that certifies or rates their suppliers in terms of a whole host of conditions, including worker welfare. And so I think Walmart sees consumer preferences shifting, and I think they might be trying to, you know, get ahead of it, or at least appear to be. A lot of folks say they're sincere, but we have to see if indeed they do follow through on some of these promises. That said, you know, every major restaurant chain in the country and retail chain in the country gets produce from Mexico, especially in the wintertime. So Americans eat Mexican produce every day.
So how much leverage? Sounds like we have a lot of leverage to force changes, and yet this is a different, it's another country. And so how much leverage do these corporations, these big corporations, have over these living conditions?
Yeah, exactly. They have enormous leverage. What happens in Mexico is there's very little to no enforcement of labor laws down there, right? So the only leverage anybody has on them is the leverage of the buyers, the enormous buyers from the U.S., like Walmart, like Safeway, like Kroger's. They are basically the regulating bodies down there. They are the government. What they say goes, because the Mexicans do produce great, very good products. They're really good at food safety, and they want to keep their market share. And if they want to keep their market share, they have to comply with the standards as declared by their buyers. So Walmart is the biggest, and they have enormous powers to shape the lives of farm workers down there, and they realize it. And if Walmart, one encouraging sign is that Walmart's efforts now hopefully could be adopted by other big retailers.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that story. Richard Morosi, reporter for the Los Angeles Times, where you should definitely check out his series on the conditions of workers at Mexican farms, where we get half of our produce. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Harvard University has been quietly snapping up swaths of farmland along California's central coast, a move that's made Harvard one of the top wine producers in the region. And Harvard's not alone in picking up thousands of acres of California farmland. Investment banks, pension funds, and insurance companies have all become some of the biggest farmers in the state. Turns out farmland is a stable and lucrative investment for those with a lot of money to spend. Not even the drought has put a damper on this farm fever. In fact, the commodification of farmland may be exacerbating the drought. Tom Philpott is the food and agriculture reporter for Mother Jones. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. So let's start with Harvard and how it became a major wine producer in Paso Robles. Is it investing in farms people already own, or is it actually owning and managing these vineyards?
In the case of Harvard, what it did was buy about 10,000 acres of existing vineyards in Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties.
And is Harvard actually managing them, or is that someone else?
Well, the way that these companies, what these big investment funds do it, is that they hire managers to come in. So Harvard, yeah, there's no like Harvard hedge fund manager or Harvard investment fund manager out there in the fields. They hire companies.
I see. And why are they interested in buying up California vineyards?
From what I can tell, and I've done a lot of reporting on this, it takes really two conditions to be met for these giant funds to be interested. One is that the land is suitable for growing a very sought-after commodity. So something like, you know, high-class wine grapes. Almonds is another huge one in California. Something that has a big export market that isn't necessarily dependent on the U.S. economy for growth. And wine and almonds both meet that. There's huge booming export markets in both those things. And the second one is easy access to water for irrigation, which is the big one. As your listeners probably know, irrigation water in California comes from two sources. One is the snow melt in the Sierra Nevada mountains that melts every year, and you've got this amazing, vast infrastructure for diverting a whole bunch of that water, most of that water, in fact, onto farms. And so you want land that has what they call water rights, good water rights. And then the second way the farms get irrigation water is simply by dropping wells and pumping it out of the ground. And over about the past 10 years, even before the drought, California agriculture was getting so intensive that the first source of water, this irrigation water gushing off the mountains, wasn't enough. And so farms have been over pumping groundwater, which of course has been exacerbated by that drought. And in the case of Harvard, when it bought the land, it immediately began dropping wells in the water and into the ground, and very, very deep wells. And in fact, it did it just before a deadline in one of those counties where groundwater was being pumped so fast that you had, you know, rapidly falling water tables. And the county put in restrictions on new wells, and Harvard got its wells in just before the restrictions went into place.
So what does that mean? They have unfettered access to the groundwater?
Yes, they got their wells in before the deadline, and so they've got unfettered access to the groundwater.
Now, does Harvard have its own label, or is this wine being produced under different labels?
It's being produced under different labels. It probably isn't even making the wine. It's probably selling the grapes and the juice to fancy winemakers. I mean, this is a very fancy wine region. It's really come on in the past couple of years. Paso Robles, where a lot of the land is, was a 2013 Wine Region of the Year from Wine Enthusiast. And so this is very high-class wine.
Okay, so it fetches a good price, as you said, that's one of the reasons why these investment funds are getting into California agriculture is the high-value crops in wines. And also you mentioned almonds, and let's talk about that. I was surprised to learn that the retirement fund TIAA CREF is involved in the almond region in the Central Valley.
Yes, it is a massive grower of almonds. It claims to be one of the world's top five biggest producers. Another one in the area is the John Hancock Investment Group. It's an insurance company, owns about 24,000 acres, also one of the biggest growers. And so these companies are moving in because interest rates are low in the United States and in most of the world, and so there's not a lot of yield in regular investments. And so what they want to do is they want to park their money in something that is both going to appreciate in value. So this California is in this farmland boom where the price of farmland keeps going up. So you have that part, and then you have the commodity that comes off of it. If you have a large and growing market for things like wine and almonds, then you both get income from the property every year by selling that stuff, and then you get the appreciation of the land. And so it's become quite a popular investment for your sort of hedge fund type.
So given the fact that we're in this drought and perhaps a mega drought that some analysts are predicting for California, and the fact that the groundwater supplies are being tapped not only by almond growers but by other farmers as well in California, are these investment companies worried that, you know, they've invested all this money in crops that need a lot of water, that there isn't going to be the water left for them? Do they care about that?
So those companies have a different time frame than, let's say, a family farmer in California. There are loads of family farmers in California growing both wine grapes and almonds. And those people are generally thinking about the next generation. What can we pass on to our children? What can future generations farm here? So they are thinking about that pretty clearly. Your Harvards and your TIA Crefts and those big investment firms have a much shorter time frame. They're thinking about maybe selling this land in 15 or 20 years. They're thinking about the next harvest, how much income they can squeeze out of the land. And as a result, they have a much shorter time frame. And if you think about the California water resources, in most places of the Central Valley, you've got a few decades of water resources that are pretty well assured. You've got a massive water table down there that is being drawn down way faster than it's replenishing, but it isn't going to go dry next year in most places. And so they're figuring we can get 10 or 15, if we get 10 or 15 good years out of this and sell it before it goes to hell, then we will have succeeded in our investment. It's a pretty scary proposition that a large and growing base of landholders are thinking on such a short time frame.
Tom Philpott, food and agriculture reporter for Mother Jones. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up on the program, Saturday Night Live spends hours last night celebrating itself as it turns 40. We'll have an assessment from our TV critics next on Press Play.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Saturday Night Live celebrated 40 years on the air this weekend with an elaborate and lengthy special last night.
Well, it's great to be here at SNL 40. It's hard to believe that this show has been going on for 40 years.
Do you mean this show right now has been going on for 40 years? Because it really feels like it.
Yeah, pretty much.
How about?
Yeah, right.
Wayne and Garth, just two of the characters brought back for the reunion, which featured cast members from every generation of the show. And in true SNL fashion, last night's broadcast was pretty much hit or miss. Joining me now to talk about that and other TV happenings are Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR. Hi, Eric.
Party on.
And Michael Schneider, executive editor for TV Guide magazine and co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
So I guess we could do all SNL refs in this entire conversation.
Cause that would be special.
So
not going to do it. Not going to do it.
Oh, my gosh. What have I done? All right. There was a lot of buzz leading up to this.
Yeah. This was sort of the Super Bowl of comedy to some degree. And it felt like it because it was 4.5 hours when you included the red carpet special that NBC did beforehand. This was a lengthy special.
Yeah. It was sort of the baton death march of comedy, maybe.
that's a little harsher. But okay.
That's a little harsher analogy. I know. Sorry about that. But you saw the generational fissures there, right? Mm-hmm. You had these boomer icons like Steve Martin and Chevy Chase on the one hand, and then you had sort of the younger upstarts, the Andy Sambergs, the Adam Sandlers, and then the younger cast members trying to sort of make their mark in a show that has become the kind of institution that it used to try to subvert. I am old enough, I hate to admit this, to have actually watched the first season when it was airing. I was about, I guess, 11 or so when I was watching it. And there was a sense at the time that something weird and odd and completely subversive was coming through your TV set on Saturday nights. And now the show is part of Hollywood's comedy institution. You had all of these sort of iconic comedians coming out to sort of pay fealty to Lorne Michaels, the guy who shepherded the show for most of its time on the air. And there was a real sense that this isn't subversive anymore. This is like watching the Oscars or, as you said, a Super Bowl.
And to your multi-generational point, let's listen to Weekend Update, this time featuring three women who all sat at that desk at one time or another: Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, and Jane Curtin.
So much of the world has changed since the show began. Back in the 70s, gas was 57 cents a gallon, and now it's $2.60. But who cares? Still gives me the same buzz.
Viewers of Saturday Night Live span several generations, from the baby boomers to Generation X, all the way to whatever you call the little dummies who are live tweeting this right now instead of watching it.
Times have changed since I first sat behind this desk. For example, I used to be the only pretty blonde woman reading the fake news. Now there's a whole network devoted to that.
So that's Jane Curtin taking a swipe at Fox News. Eric, you say that was your favorite joke of the night?
Yeah, I thought that was the best line of the night because it sort of summed up how much things have changed. And it handed a great line to someone who had been a part of the show since it started. And unfortunately, there were way too few of those kinds of lines. And what was sort of odd to me is that there weren't enough moments where you had that kind of perspective, where you could see how far the show had come, and you had great lines that sort of summed up the comedic journey that we've all been on with the show.
The ratings, I guess, were pretty good last night, but
fantastic.
In general,
yeah.
Saturday Night Live ratings, not so hot so, especially in the younger demo, right?
This is one of those bridge years where, there's a lot of new cast members on the show this season. A lot of them are still finding their way, and SNL has gone through, peaks and valleys through the years, and right now, unfortunately, they're in one of their valleys.
Well, what do you think? Do you think that it'll be around for another 40 years?
It sort of feels like it at this point. I mean, it is an institution. The big question is, does this show survive Lorne Michaels? Once Lorne Michaels can no longer do the show, does it continue? And that's going to be the big question.
Also, Lorne Michaels has become sort of a power center at NBC. Not only is he running Saturday Night Live, of course, but he is the mind behind Jimmy Fallon and his ascension. So now he controls The Tonight Show. He controls Seth Meyers, the show that airs after him. He also minted Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, and they had major shows on NBC. He is the architect of a huge portion of NBC's comedy lineup in primetime and in late night. I agree with Michael. Not until Lorne Michaels actually leaves the scene or his power is greatly diminished will anything happen to that show. But another 40 years, I would be amazed if that show was still on.
Never say never. Yeah. Never say never with Saturday Night Live. Okay, let's talk about The Jinx. That's on Sunday nights. HBO's six-part documentary series about three murders surrounding a man named Robert Durst. He's a very rich man from New York. Last night was the second installment, and here's a clip from it.
Durst was wanted for murder in Texas. He was a suspect for murders in Los Angeles and Westchester County, New York.
He belongs to one of the richest families in New York City.
Might be a little eccentric.
I think Bob is very smart. I mean, he's managed to get away with three murders.
He is being unfairly accused. Bob Durst may be the unluckiest man in the world. Lonely.
Well, I thought he was darling.
He's not crazy. He's diabolical.
I believed him from the very beginning.
All right, you guys, what do you think of the show, Michael?
It's funny. When they first brought it out, it sort of in some ways reminded me of the podcast Serial. And I even said at the time, if you liked Serial, then you'll really like The Jinx. And I think it's living up to expectations so far. I mean, it's really interesting filmmaking, and the fact that it's not just one documentary, but it's a series kind of unfolds week after week. And I kind of like the storytelling.
Eric?
Yeah, I agree. I think what they've done is they've taken the kind of programming that we normally see, like, CBS's 48 Hours or Dateline NBC often does this, goes back and finds a legendary crime and kind of retells it. But they found sort of an iconic figure, an iconic sort of series of circumstances, and then got the guy at the center of it, the person that normally doesn't talk. He talks. And it turns out that this guy is just the most charismatic, eccentric, bizarre figure that you can ever imagine, and he's perfect for television, and he's perfect for this kind of storytelling. And it's true, it does feel like a visual equivalent of Serial. There's some things that The critic in me is concerned about, you know, recreations and the, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between sort of archival footage and things that they have redone for this movie. But it is a really compelling look at a guy who somehow seems to have gotten away with three murders and is also sort of the product of one of the wealthiest families in the country. It is really compelling.
I mean, it's interesting that this is taking a kind of investigative approach in the sense that you mentioned Serial. And do you ever question whether documentary filmmakers should be doing this ethically, crossing the line into becoming investigators and almost part of the story, or at least advancing the story forward in real life and maybe changing some significant events instead of just observing them and documenting them?
I think to some degree it becomes inevitable. Andrew Jarecki, I mean, he, the director of this, this was real goldmine that he found and sort of he became a part of this guy's life. So to some degree you can't help it. And if he is having an impact, this documentary is having an impact, then you sort of have to document it. You have to break that fourth wall, that camera, and sort of expose, okay, this is all happening because of this documentary.
I would say there's a difference between the documentary breaking ground and the person who makes the documentary becoming part of the story. To make an allusion to another huge media story, the Brian Williams story, I think the lesson people are not necessarily focusing on is that in today's media and today's news especially, we're in a situation where people, they like the idea of identifying with the storyteller and seeing the story through that storyteller's eyes. Mm. And that is really seductive and that is dangerous, because when you change the story to put yourself at the center of it more and more, that's when you get into trouble.
Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR, and Michael Schneider, executive editor for TV Guide magazine and co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And getting back to Saturday Night Live, we want to know your favorite SNL skit of all time. Call us 1-844-PRESSPLAY, or you can tweet us at KCRW PressPlay. Coming up, a portrait of one of the best photojournalists of our time, Sebastião Salgado. He's the subject of one of the five documentaries nominated for an Oscar. His story, as told by his son, after a news update with Eric Roy.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Sebastião Salgado has traveled the world taking photographs of human suffering. For 40 years, he's taken brutal and beautiful black and white pictures of starvation in the African Sahel, of workers in the burning oil fields of Kuwait, and of the hellish conditions of gold miners in Brazil. He's considered one of the most important photographers of our time, both for his artistry but also for forcing us to pay attention to things and to people we'd rather not see. Now, the documenter has become the documented in one of the five nonfiction films nominated for an Oscar. It's perhaps the most lyrical and least narrative of the five, featuring Salgado describing some of his most moving and painful photographs, narrated by the director, Wim Wenders.
A film about the life of a photographer? Maybe it's good at the beginning to remember where the word comes from. In Greek, photo meant light. Graph was writing, drawing. A photographer is literally somebody drawing with light. A man writing and rewriting the world with lights and shadows.
Salt of the Earth is directed by Wenders, along with Giuliano Salgado, the eldest son of Sebastião Salgado. And Giuliano joins us today. Welcome.
Hello.
Well, your dad grew up in rural Brazil, and then he became an economist. And then he just decided to chuck all that to become a photographer traveling the world, taking photographs in faraway places. How did he come to that decision to do that?
We're speaking late 60s, early 70s. It's a moment, you know, in which the world is moving. The decolonization is going on all in Africa. And it's a time for new ideas. I guess Sebastio at the time really wanted to be close to that. He wanted to see this for his own eyes, and also probably he was moved by the idea that he could be some kind of an adventurer, someone who could be in those places.
For many years, he traveled across the globe. And he says in your movie, how many times did I lay my cameras down to cry over what I'd seen?
Je me suis retiré d'ici en ne croyant plus à rien. Je ne croyais pas qu'il avait de salut pour l'espèce humaine. On ne pouvait pas survivre une chose pareille. On ne méritait pas de vivre non plus. Personne ne méritait de vivre.
How did documenting all this suffering and misery and just unimaginable horrors, including the Rwandan genocide, how did that affect him?
You know, Sebastio is Brazilian, and as such, he's got this this absolute optimism that things are always going to get better. And I think that's what kept him going. Somehow, his photography kept, you know, playing this role, you know, with the idea that they could help to make a difference, participate in that. But then at some point, when he went to Rwanda, when he was witnessing the genocide, he realized that some situations, they are completely hopeless. After that, he couldn't go on the way he was going on. He couldn't, you know, be a social photographer anymore. He couldn't travel the same way. So he had to change. And as Wim says, unfortunately, you know, my co-director Wim Wenders, he's not here today. He says that it takes a lot of courage for someone to understand that, you know, it's time to change and you can't go on the way you've been. That's a way also to keep your soul together.
You were a child while he was making these trips and these projects that took him years to do. And he spent many years away from your home, you and your mother, in Paris. And so was this project an effort on your part to really get to know your father, that maybe you didn't know him as well as you wanted to?
When we started, Sebastio and I, we, you know, that happens sometimes in the best families. We had those, you know, son and father problems.
Yeah.
Problems of communication. Everything got a little bit harder when I became a teenager. And when we started the movie, we could barely speak about anything else than sports, soccer in our case, and whatever it is we were going to eat. So it was very, you know, complicated for me, this situation. We traveled the first time to visit an Indian tribe in, you know, lost paradise in the Amazonia, the Zoe tribe. They live exactly as they used to live 15,000 years ago. And they have a very different way, you know, of dealing with all those familiar issues. They're very loving, they're very caring, they don't fight ever. And while we were there, those 3 weeks that we were there, I was very scared when I accepted to go. I thought we would be in a Herzog-Kinski kind of situation, you know, fight.
Yeah.
And actually, everything went really fine. When we got back to Paris, I edited those pictures, 20-minute short film. And when Sebastio saw them, something really powerful happened to us. You know, a camera, it doesn't lie. It says a lot about the person that's taking the pictures. And I was filming Sebastio, I was filming my father, and when he was watching those pictures, he saw exactly the way I saw him. He was watching at his son gaze over him. That touched him a lot. He was so moved. It was so obvious how moved he was. And that made, you know, that played a very important role to us. It opened the idea. It opened, you know, the fact that we could make a film together. This was going to be his last a big work. So it was a very good moment to make a film about him. And suddenly it was possible. Much later, when we were editing the film already, Wim had interviewed Sebastio over what's the core of our film. All those amazing experiences, unique experiences Sebastio has had over those 40 years, confronting himself, you know, with people, most of the time in crisis situations, and seeing what's the most beautiful and the most important to learn, but also the most difficult and the most barbarian things. And when I saw all of that, then suddenly, you know, that changed me. I saw how much he had to pass through, how much he had to learn, how much he had to give. And that changed our relationship. When I saw him again, I had moved a little bit, and that was enough for us to become friends.
he saw how you saw him through the lens. And there are scenes in the movie where Sebastio's face is looking at his own pictures as he describes them. And so you see the pictures and then you see him reacting to seeing the pictures. And I'm just wondering about how that process happened and what it revealed to Sebastio and to you.
You know, Madeleine, this is the luck we've had to work with such a master of cinema as Wim Wenders is. He found this way of filming Sebastio that was so powerful. He actually brought Sebastio to a studio. He was completely isolated from the team. And in front of the camera, we have put a teleprompter. But in this teleprompter, there wasn't a text. There were only photographies. And Wim was only switching from one photo to the other. And Sebastio was completely drawn again, you know, in the moments that he was living when he took those photos. And that's how, you know, he managed to recall all those amazing moments that, you know, he went through during those 40 years of traveling the world. That was very powerful. Mm. At some point, we were in Rwanda seeing those photos, and the emotional, you know, impact of those photos, of the stories, it was so strong that what you see in the film, it's almost real time. He couldn't go on longer. It was too hard for him.
Mm. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Giuliano Salgado. He's the son of famous photographer Sebastio Salgado, the subject of the new documentary.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Misery, human misery of making it into something like a beautiful object. And I'm wondering how you respond to that and how he responds to that.
Listen, I think Susan Sontag's comment, somehow, you know, it doesn't only address Sebastio, it addresses the whole, you know, profession.
Yeah.
And it's a fair comment. I mean, when you see newspapers or sometimes in radio stations as well, TV, the most important and terrible news are, you know, in between two spots of advertising. And somehow there is this idea that maybe people are putting those news out just to be able to make more money with the advertising. And that's something that we all have to assess, you know. It's part of the dangers, you know, of our communication world. Now, as far as Sebastio's concerned, I think that's very different. In the film, we see very well the way that he travels, how much he spends time with the people that, you know, he's going to photograph. Somehow he becomes part of them. And in no way you can compare Sebastio with someone that would just come, steal a picture, bring it back and make some money out of it. There is something else on Sebastio's work. And I came to realize when he was doing his Ethiopian work during 86, 84, 86, during the Ethiopia starvation, I was only 10, but that's when his photos started appearing, you know, in front news, covers of important newspapers. And then, you know, suddenly there was something else to Sebastio's photo. They had a meaning. And they were playing a role, you know, creating awareness, bringing images, stories of people that very often were the forgotten people of history. And I think that's the role that he kind of set himself, and that's actually the role his photos have been playing. And if Susan had the opportunity to see our film, I'm sure she would have agreed to that this critic is actually unfair and doesn't apply to Sebastio.
Early on in the movie, you know, we see him talk about his photos of these unimaginable horrors in Rwanda and elsewhere. These pictures, he took pictures of you know, the suffering that man does to man. And he basically says he has no hope for humanity. He's so depleted by what he has seen. I think there's one scene where he's talking about the pictures he took of a bulldozer bulldozing bodies in Rwanda because there were so many of them they couldn't be buried properly. And it just seems at that moment that he's given up hope. And then yet it turns around because at the end he goes on this, he has this new project that you document and you go with him called Genesis, where he's decided he's not going to take pictures of people anymore. And through taking pictures of animals and the environment, he's had a turnaround. I wonder if you can talk about that.
You know, all this suffering that he witnessed, all those situations that he was confronted with, that he couldn't really protect himself from because he was so involved with the people that he was photographing. That did a lot, you know. It was a big hardship on him. He had to change. Somehow, the simple fact of starting to plant trees on my grandfather's farm, that was in such a depleted situation, looked like a desert at this point. That sort of, you know, created a new impulse. Somehow I think Sebastio managed to find a balance. If I didn't know him, I would say it's a completely zen kind of, you know, movement. Find balance in things, manage to project himself and find empathy for trees, for beautiful places, places that are still, you know, as they were before, you know, the event of our industrial society. And somehow this last work, his last work, Genesis, it's a wishful view of what the world could be if we found the ways to respect it, if we found the ways to live, you know, in harmony with it. So I'd say Sebastio, in this transformation, somehow he became a real artist. Before, he was a photojournalist. He was, you know, reporting facts and events, people's life. And somehow, after this point where he had to change his ways, he was sharing his vision of what the world should be, some kind of an utopia. And I think that's the work of a real artist.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today about your father.
Thank you, Madeleine.
Giuliano Salgado, he directed Salt of the Earth about his father, Sebastio Salgado, with Wim Wenders. The movie Salt of the Earth is nominated for an Academy Award, and you can see it in theaters beginning in April. By the way, we'll have conversations with the directors of the rest of the Oscar-nominated documentaries every day this week at this time in the show. All right, coming up, who on Earth would want to get on a spaceship and head to Mars knowing there would be no coming back? Well, a lot of people, it turns out. We're going to find out more about them next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A one-way ticket to Mars sounds a little bit like a suicide mission, but a lot of people are interested. 2 years ago, a Dutch group called Mars One created a competition to find applicants, and more than 200,000 people signed up. Now the selection process narrowed the field to 100 people, 38 of whom are from the United States. Mars One says the plan is to send a team of four to the Red Planet in the year 2024. So that is 9 years from now. The projected cost, $6 billion. The group plans to raise some of that money by televising the rest of the competition. Peter Savodnik is executive producer of Stateless Media, which has made a 10-minute documentary called If I Die on Mars about some of the people who've applied to go on this mission. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. So how would you characterize these people? Are they absolutely insane?
No, they're not insane. They are very adventurous, very excited about space, about Mars. They also seem not to care as much about things that lots of us care about, things like eating well, seeing loved ones.
Oxygen.
Oxygen, all those things. They seem to be less tethered to the Earth, you might say.
Yeah. Well, how did Mars One winnow the competition down from 200,000 to just 100?
So a lot of that, I think, is, you know, there's any number of traits that just sort of come through on their initial internet applications, and they submitted videos, and I think those are all reviewed. Then there were, I believe, some phone interviews or internet interviews. Then they had more applications, and they just went from 660 to 100. And that's actually, you know, like now we're down, we're getting close. So you begin to see the traits that are really beginning to sort of stand out. It's clear that they care a lot about people who are very knowledgeable about space exploration, people who have a certain kind of inner fortitude that perhaps your typical would-be astronaut does not have.
Are they looking for real astronauts?
You know, I don't know about that. You know, Mars One could answer better than I think what they seem very, very keen on is, I guess there are two things. One, you know, what do you, the candidate, have? How much do you know? What's your personality like? And then also, how are you going to fit with other potential crewmates? You know, obviously, one of the big dangers that a mission like this faces is that everyone is at each other's throats by, you know, week two as they're hurtling through space. So you want to make sure that you have the right constellation of personalities together on this, essentially this crock pod hurtling from Earth to Mars.
How long does it take to get there?
It would take, I believe, about 9 months.
9 months. And then once you're there forever.
Forever.
And you can't come back.
You cannot come back. I think there were some hopes expressed that, you know, at some point we would develop a technology to send a spacecraft to Mars that would be able to take people back. But that's probably wishful thinking. I think that those who go will go with the expectation that for all intents and purposes, they will be dead on Earth.
Well, are they apocalyptic type of people? Do they think that life on Earth is kind of a done deal and that this is a better future for them?
I think there's a mix. When we started out with pre-production, we were looking for three categories of candidates. We were looking for a candidate to star in the movie. We were looking for a candidate who we label as sort of negative, somebody who was clearly running away from Earth, that relationship, credit card debt, whatever. We were looking for a candidate who was very positive, who clearly just wanted to go to Mars, who was fascinated by the idea of colonizing another planet. And then we were looking for a character who was distinctly ambivalent, or I should say ambiguous, somebody we really couldn't discern one way or the other. And as it turned out, everyone we eventually settled on was an ambiguous candidate. It's unclear sort of exactly what drives everyone. I think to some degree, everyone has a certain, I wouldn't say apocalyptic view of the Earth, but a sense that there is more out there and that there are opportunities, civilizations waiting to be created on other planets and in other solar systems.
Men, women, young, old?
All of the above.
So I understand one of the people that you interviewed made it to the final 100.
Yes.
Who is this person?
Ryan McDonald. He's a physics student at Oxford. Super smart, articulate, a very, very, I would say, charismatic young man. Really, really knowledgeable about everything involved in the journey and the whole process of establishing a base, as it were, on Mars. And also somebody who I think has, in many ways, been working towards something like this for a long time. He's been studying physics seriously for a long time. He thinks about travel to space in a way that I think most of us don't. It's not science fiction to Ryan so much as just science.
And does he think that he'll be, you know, the first colonizer, that he'll be part of a whole new community of people living on Mars?
Yeah, I think that's exactly how he envisions it.
So it's not just a big science experiment for him. It is actual creating a new world, creating a new way of living.
Yeah, that's right. And I think actually one of the challenges facing some of the candidates, including Ryan, is going to be sort of thinking about this in a more holistic way. This is not just about equations and analyzing radiation levels and finding the right spacesuit to contend with dust storms. There's also the kind of larger anthropological question of, you know, who are we and what are we going to become? There are big fundamental questions involving, you know, culture and religion and politics. And I think in a way that's maybe too much for the initial colonizers to worry about. They're going to have to think about just getting there and then surviving. But I think they're also aware in the back of their minds that if it materializes, this is going to be the beginning of something really gargantuan.
Well, that's a big if, right? I mean, they need to raise $6 billion and actually create some kind of living situation on Mars.
Right.
So how likely is it that this is actually going to happen?
I mean, you have plenty of very smart naysayers, and there are a lot of really reasonable criticisms that have been lodged against the whole idea. But I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility. Look, I'm not a rocket scientist. I'm not Elon Musk. I'm not in a position to say, you know, how likely this is to succeed. But it does look like a very, very serious operation. And people who are very smart, who have been thinking of this for a long time, seem to think that Mars One has as good a shot as anyone right now. So I think we ought to take them very seriously and watch their progress over the next 9 years.
Well, Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter Svodnik, executive producer of Stateless Media. He's made a 10-minute documentary called If I Die on Mars. It's about some of the people that have applied to go on the Mars One mission. And you can see that documentary at our website, kcrw.com/pressplay. Well, hello there, Julie Myers.
Oh, hi, Madeline.
Welcome to the week.
Thank you.
Happy President's Day.
A very, very special happy President's Day to you
thank
as well.
You. Thank you. I'll be shopping for some sheets later.
I've got so many of those stupid, like, furniture, like, President's Day blowout sale in my email box. They just keep coming. That's not what you guys were talking about today, at least not with us. We talked about SNL's 40th anniversary, and I guess that they riffed on one of my favorite bits of all time last night, the Californians, which gives me an excuse to play the following.
I think you should go home now, Devin.
There's nothing going on, Stuart.
You should go home. Get back on San Vicente, take it to the 10, then switch over to the 405 North and let it dump you out into Mulholland where you belong.
It's funny because it's true, Madeline.
Oh, they hate the Californians, those
I'm
SNLers.
Sorry, but that is 100,000% true, down to like the fresh avocados they bring out. Do you have a favorite SNL?
So many to choose from.
Yes.
Well, there's obviously the, you know, good food inspired.
Oh, sure.
Balls.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
ball.
Sure, man. Sure, Madeline. Yeah, so that's great.
It's delicious. Sprockets. I'm showing my age.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, I know you don't because you're younger. Toonces, the driving cat.
That's okay. That's the one where
for
the
just the most silly of silliness.
We have some Googling to do after this and some YouTube.
It always ended with the cat driving the car off a cliff.
Perfect.
So, yeah.
Perfect.
Exactly.
That's actually something that happens often in my life, so that's relevant to my experience. Let's get to our listeners because their opinions matter as well. Heather Klink tweets that hands down Massive Head Wound Harry is the best SNL skit of all time, in which Dana Carvey shows up at a dinner party with a massive head wound.
Would you like to lay down? Maybe in the garage?
No, I just need some food to get my strength back. I lost a lot of blood on the way over here.
Oh, you gotta try some of these shrimp, friend.
Yeah. Heather! Good Lord. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me help you with that.
He bends down to pick up a dropped shrimp and dips his head wound into the cocktail sauce, hence the horror. You guys can hit us with your favorite SNL skits, Twitter, at KCRW Press Play.
All right. Thank you, Jolie Myers and Warren Olney. To the point, up next at 1 o'clock, I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.